Session number 1360, George Saunders, part one.
Can you tell me how and when you came to go to the Malayan emergency, please?
Right. Well, in that case, I have to quickly state what happened. I left the army as a sergeant. I was never commissioned, which I was rather sad about, because all my friends from school, of course, were serving officers in various regiments. I actually had an interview with the commanding officer of the 12th Lancers, and he asked me, what is my private income? And I said, I'm afraid none. And he said, well, I don't think you'll be all that happy in our regiment. And that's a fact. Afterwards, I met my wartime brigadier, Lord Lovett, whom I liked very much. And did we talk about Normandy? That he stood on the beach, had flicked the sand off his...
Yes.
Right. Yep. And he said, you bloody idiot, why didn't you just accept the whatever commission they gave you in Pioneer Corps or whatever, and I would have quickly whipped you out of that and gone back into commandos. However, you see, I was recommended for a commission by Lord Lovett, but as I served in 45 Marine Commando, I was interviewed by three admirals. I don't think I mentioned this, actually. And they said, well, you're not British-born, are you? And I said, no. And are your parents British-born? I said, of course not. They are German nationals. And they said, well, in that case, I don't think we're in a position to grant you a naval commission. That would have been in the Marine Commandos, you see. I said, well, sir, looked sternly at this most senior admiral of this triumvirate. When the shit was flying, nobody cared a bugger where I came from. And now you're questioning my ancestry. Saluted, marched, and turned out. That episode, because you must be courteous to admirals. And then that was an army sergeant afterwards. And that story reached Lord Lovett, and he said, you fucking idiot, why didn't you just accept whatever they offered you, and maybe you would have got a commission in the Pioneer Corps, the arse end of the British Army, and that would have whipped you out, and you could have taken over Lovett's scouts or something. However, they're finished now. Anyway, I got demobbed as a sergeant, and that was somewhat of a cloud in the last day or two. I think I took my start. Because I was area intelligence officer in the northern half of left of the Rhine, you know, more or less from Cologne to the Dutch border, but I was only a sergeant, and so I wasn't entitled to the privileges of the officer who should be a major. You see, I had field security sections under me, which were headed by junior officers or subalterns or sergeants. I was a sergeant running the field security, which was a major's post, really. However, and luckily I had a protector who was the area intelligence he was the intelligence officer at the army level up in Bad Oeynhausen or somewhere, you see. However, he protected me because whenever he, you know, I don't know, but I told you my cook was the sort of third or fourth cook in the Krupp household, which I found systematically, and my paperwork was done by a Abwehr Oberst, I mean a lieutenant, an Oberstleutnant Abwehr, an intelligence lieutenant colonel of the German army, who knew which side his parent was caviar. And I said, look, my boy, all I want to know, everything that went on, would go on, you prepare me a weekly report, everything that happens, you know, in the area. And all I had to do, work about an hour or 2 a week, and translated this report of this excellent chap, who was paid in coffee and cigarettes and sardines and what have you, you know. And in those days, it was a court-martial offense to fraternize with Germans, you see. And but I thought, oh, fuck that for a lark, all these field security sections whizzing around, stirring like a fox stirring up a chicken house, coming back with a ticket. I threw their reports in the waste paper basket without reading them. And I had to just translate this man's report and went about Oeynhausen. And so my colonel, he was called Strangeways, Colonel Strangeways. He was at army level, you know. He was a full colonel, intelligence. And I was continuously criticized by my colleagues, all of whom were commissioned and of senior rank. And he said, look, as long as I can dispatch Saunders' reports to London as they are, I don't care a bugger how he says about it, because I had this good cook from the Krupp household who prepared delicious meals, and I had sort of, you know, girlies, you know, joined us for dinner, and I left him to the upstairs of the villa after dinner. So, that's how I did it. Anyway, I might have talked about this before. That's how I came out of the army. And there was a bit of a cloud because I took my army car it's all right if you're a captain or a major and you take your staff car to the demob center, but not if you're a sergeant, you can't arrive with driver in the army car. So there was a stink about that. I don't know whether I mentioned this, but towards the end of the war, you had to, as people were demobbed, you had to apply to some source or another for replacements. And as I had a staff of 11, I believe, or 12, including me, this meant to be, a major, a subaltern, a sergeant, maybe a lance corporal. All I kept is one lance corporal driver, because I had to fetch rations every day for 11 or 12 people, you see. And from that, I paid my staff and fed my horses, you see, because I had horses, Krefeld race course. So I needed the rations for 12 people to run my personal establishment. So all of this was criticized, of course, and my departure. I think I almost came to be court-martialed, but I avoided that. Because I turned up at the demob center somewhere with, I don't know where, with my driver, and because I just kept my lance corporal driver and I had a staff car to which I wasn't entitled. That's how I turned up for my demob. Okay, was demob, went home. And I must say, this is a personal note, nothing to do with military adventures. In the latter half of the war, I had a girlfriend who I was very fond of. Her husband was a taipan. You know what a taipan is?
Yes.
Taipan is a head of a hong, one of the old-fashioned firms created before 1860 in Hong Kong. And that was a hong, but they were Quakers, and they did not deal in opium, so they were not as rich as Butterfield and Swire and Jardine Matheson. And Jardine Matheson have the proud name of Iwo, that means number one. So he had a gravelly whiskey voice. He was a friendly chap, and he said, "Oh, well, you want to marry Carol, you might as well have a decent job and some money." And by that time, actually, this girl and I had enough of each other. But I said, "Now look, don't tell Daddy because I need that job." We decided not to marry. I mean, I wasn't being nasty. I just right. And then got this job in Hong Kong. That was in 1946, I think, just after my demob. Oh, yes, yeah, and I went to some school of business studies the army provided in the station museum. And, right. And I not only not married the daughter of the chairman and managing director, but a local girl who was half Russian, half Japanese. And that was the end of my first job, very smartly. In between, I tried to climb Lion Rock, fell off, broke my back. You know Hong Kong or not?
I've heard about it.
The aeroplanes fly this rock and away, and people say it's never been climbed, and I thought I must climb that, and I fell off and so on. However, right, and so once more, I was without a job, without visible means of support, because by that time my army, not golden handshake, sort of copper handshake, ran out. Then with this little wife, who was very pregnant, went to Goldenstone, my alma mater, and the headmaster greeted me with open arms, and I said, I'm very glad you've come, my boy, I've just sacked the athletics master, and you can come take over tomorrow. And then after a week I had to teach Latin as well, because the classics master was overworked. And at the end of that term, I worked in Goldenstone, they gave me £50. And I thought, my goodness, I can't afford to live on that. Goldenstone always, they do it now even, and they give practically no pensions. So, but by that time, I heard that Tony Grebel Bell was in London, and I had not met him before, but I had an introduction to him. He's called Tony Grebel Bell. Whether he was a major or a captain, I do not know. He was out of the army because he was a soldier after my own heart. I mean, he had an affair with even though he was married with the wife of the Spanish ambassador, who was a duke, and so on, you know. And he's a real sort of, you know, many of these people, about which I will talk later, they were brilliant wartime soldiers and lost in peacetime. And I'm sure you've heard that before. I shall talk about one or two. And then I met him, and at that time he had an affair with the Duchess of whatever. I've forgotten her name. Was it Alba? I don't know. and the Duke was furious with him, and then he went off, and he had a yacht, and he shipped nefarious goods from North Africa to Spain, and he was captured in a Spanish prison. Have you never heard of that soldier, Tony Grebel Bell?
I've heard the name.
Yes.
Not the details.
What his love life or his smuggling exploits.
No, no.
Anyway, he rotted in a Spanish jail, the poor chap, because the Duke saw to that, you see, because he wanted his wife to be left alone. Biddy kindly gave him an introduction to 21st SES. They had in those days, they had a sort of a bit of a headquarters. Their name called themselves Artists Rifles. It was a holding regiment, you might have heard of them. And near Houston. That was, one met there and met people and so on. And then I volunteered to go. They said, oh, well, they need chaps. And I volunteered to go out to the Far East. And I said, you know, I've been another rank long enough during the war. And that, because I believe of my German background, I never got commissioned. And
but what was your motive for volunteering for it?
I had no money and no job. I wanted a job, and the army was nice. You held out your hand and you got paid. You had people above you and people below you, and you did what you were told, and it was fun. And so I thought, and anyway, I knew the Far East a little bit through my thing in Hong Kong, and thought that's what I'll do. And by that time, anyway, I lunched with, I gave this man, Tony Grebel Bell, I gave him lunch at my club in London, and I said, you know, it's really incongruous, I mean, I must have a commission, and I'm prepared to join. He said, why don't you just join as a private soldier? I'll write to Colonel Mike and say that you should be commissioned on arrival or shortly after. But I was really penniless and had needed a job and money, and so I...
Colonel Mike is Michael Calvert.
Calvert, yeah, right. And so I never met him before. Okay, so I signed up, joined as a private soldier, and just to get myself an occupation and an income. You see, that was a time when people still came out of the army in droves, and I just got the sack from this firm in Hong Kong. Where I did not manage to marry the daughter of the managing director, so he wouldn't have given me a nice recommendation. And he had me in his office, you know, well, I don't mind, but Ruth Mary is bitching. Ruth Mary was the wife, you see. And in those days, we were wild young men and sort of, and If you were a member of a Hong, I mean one of these big companies, you know, you had unlimited credit, which you could use as in restaurants, brothels, wherever, you know, just sign your initials. And we did wild things, tobogganing down on trays the on Saturday night of the major hotel, the crypts, and so on, you know. And anyway, so I wasn't in a position to get a recommendation. And then, as I told you, Gordonstoun paid me £50 for a term as a teacher. So I really had to, and I believed that if I joined once more, I would get, and it was at that time I wrote to Lord Lovett, who was my brigadier, Nicol Gray, who was my colonel, and forget my own name next. I met Anto Colonel Laycock. Peter Laycock, I believe. And they wrote me glowing recommendations, which I put in my pocket, and I thought on the strength of this, being a soldier in action, I would get my commission. This is what Tony Gable Bell promised me, right? However, then for weeks on end, our aeroplane didn't leave, and then they decided to ship us by sea, and then they said, oh, but I mean, you have these mountaineering qualifications. I must mention that the only professional qualification I attained in my misspent youth, I'm a qualified mountain guide and ski instructor. That's not very useful in Malaya. But so I told the SAS, why don't I run a course for high mountain warfare in Malnitz. That was in Austria. And they were sending a small party, because the SAS, I mean the holding agent was the Arthur's Rifles, but the SAS always considered themselves, being able to produce a small unit of specialists, either on mountains or at the sea or whatever, you know, parachuting and so on. And so I went to Malnitz and skied there, and they sent me people, 6, 8, 10, and I had a very nice winter holiday there. Joined by my wife and my little son, and then went to St. Anton in Austria, that is, you know, and exercised my profession of ski teacher. Well, then suddenly my seriousness started, and then we were, because I was available, I was by that time on paper a private soldier in 21st SAS, you know, living in Malnitz, it's in Austria, do you know where it is?
No.
Malnitz, Malnitz, it's a sort of a local resort on the other side of these mountains where this is sort of a place where Bad Kastein, that is where the sort of place where one's aunts went before the war for the waters or something. And they had a lot of hotels there, and so that's why they became a ski resort. Anyway. And it was great fun, and I met a lot of chums, you know, and including Angus Ogilvy, who's married into the royal family in between, and so on, you know. And Lawrence Rook, who rode in badminton many times, and so on. So and it was great fun. They sort of young men came. Funnily enough, they all seemed to be officers. They never seemed to, the 21st SAS High Mountain Warfare Unit never seemed to have private soldiers. Right. Then we were shipped out I went for a few days, 2 or 3 days, to barracks in Aldershot, and then caught a ship with the rest of this intake, 15, 16 people, about that many. Are you sure I haven't mentioned this in the previous interview?
No, you didn't.
Right. Anyway, that was quite nice, 3, 4 weeks on ship, you know. And, you know, I mean, it was very basic, you know. You know, there's no sort of luxury like normal ocean travel. On arrival, There was a three tonner, and a tough looking chap.
Is this in Singapore?
Singapore, with a barrel chest, moustache. Came out and said, we were all privates. There wasn't a single officer or NCO in that group. He said, who is in charge of this shower? So I looked, well, having been a sergeant towards the end of the war, I thought I was. I said, I am, sir. And he said, all right, where's your kit? Well, it's here. And this is the one thing about Michael Calvert. He was, I found this out later, he was a missionary. He did, which he thought was right. He had no pretensions whatsoever. I mean, most half colonels meeting, first of all, most half colonels wouldn't be bothered to go down to the docks and meet a new intake. Secondly, they'd come in a staff car driven by a lance corporal and send a driver with a three tonner. But Michael Calvert sat in front of the three tonner next to a driver. So he said, now look, here's a map of Singapore. You're here, harbor. Singapore Island, here's the causeway, Majidi Barracks, the other side. Not very far, 25 miles. I saluted, said, thank you, sir. He took the kit, sat next to the driver, and off they went, you see. And I said, look, boys, I know Singapore. I've been here before. Two can play that game. In the tropics, 25 miles, just along 5-6 hours, you know. And so let's go and have a nice lunch. Who's got some money, you know, clubbed together in a hat, took two or three taxis, went off the in the next of the mosque in Singapore, there's a various good curry restaurants. And I knew the place, you know, from passing through to and from Hong Kong. And so, so we went there, had a marvelous lunch, you know, 3-4 hours. And then got this fleet of taxis, went across the island, paid them off the southern end of the causeway, and marched incredibly smartly across the causeway. It's only a mile to Majidi Barracks from there. And there, at the guard room, was the colonel. So I considered myself in command and said, eyes left! You know, saluted the colonel, marched smartly past him. He saluted back. He bloody well knew we hadn't marched. But I'm telling you this story of no great military interest, but he was that sort of chap, you see. He would judge us by that, you see. And I mean, he did, and then later on I found that he did it with all intakes. And if there was a straggler, he put them into the headquarters, which meant, of course, it was the worst administration, because a man who isn't fit is also not a very good soldier, you see, and not a good administrator. You must have both. You I mean, in my opinion, I may be wrong. Is there, you know, a good mind can only be in a good body, not the other way around, you know. So any straggler, I mean, if it was an officer who was a straggler, he made him adjutant, and if it was an NCO, he was office sergeant or something. And so, I mean, it was the best administrative regiment ever. Well, I'll come to that later. Anyway, there are Majidi Barracks, a little basic training, and then we went up to Kuala Lumpur, a place called, you must bear with me, because in those days I was in my late 20s. Now I'm in my early 70s. Dusun Tua. Dusun means old, Tua means old, Dusun is orchard, old orchard. And what amazed me actually that my colleagues, the other ranks, had no interest in the country, nor the first thing I did on arrival in Malaya, set about learning Malay. I've always done this, tried to find out about the country where I served in. I mean, so happened in Germany's book, for them that have a smattering of French, you see. And that was a Japanese camp, And Colonel Mike, there was very little room. The unit of Gu and he prepared for operations. That was just at the beginning, you see, the intakes came 8, 12, 15, that sort of thing, you know. And when he had it more or less up to strength, but in between I've heard sort of all sorts of stories, I mean, about Colonel Mike from other people. Even though I was a private soldier in that regiment, I had, because I was a member of the Hong Kong Club in Hong Kong, I had reciprocal facilities with other establishments in Singapore and in Kuala Lumpur. So I heard sort of in these places things about Michael Calvert and the thing. I mean, providing you have a white suit on or something. I mean, those days you still had to wear a suit to go to the club and a tie, you know, at night for dinner. The daytime you come off in collar. And so I had this, and I had a few friends, you know, who were barristers and Malay Civil MCS. MCS is very Indian Civil Service was the top, and MCS came second. You know, it was sort of, right. Then eventually, and of course, that camp sort of grew up, was established while we were stationed there. And as I told you, Colonel Mike was a doer. I was never on Christian name terms with him because I was a private soldier and he was a half colonel. But I did have conversations with him. To me, he was just sir, you see. And I was Private Saunders. But he did sort of talk to me, and I found him very, very interesting, you see. And later on, when I was very ill, he sat by my bed and chatted to me. But
what type of things would he say to you?
Oh, well, about Tony Armstrong. No, sorry. Tony Greville Bell. Not Armstrong. Tony Greville Bell and his adventures in London. He loved to hear this, and having had an affair with the Duchess or whatever, the wife of the Spanish ambassador and so on, you know. And as I say, he had no size. I mean, you wouldn't get a situation that a half colonel chats to a private. It wouldn't occur in other regiments, you see. And but he liked to keep the regiment in a turbulent condition. And he told junior officers that they must assert themselves by personality and not by virtue of their rank. That when you're in the middle of the jungle, rank doesn't help you, it's your personality what counts. A lot of this made a lot of good sense, you see, in wartime, but not in peacetime. And his real mistake was when he signed for a camp to a crooked garrison engineer, an Indian garrison engineer, when in fact it wasn't complete. He only found it out after he signed. That, of course, contributed to his court-martial, you see. And the negligence and so all that sort of thing. He was a man who liked to ladle out of a full barrel. You know, he said, people in the jungle, they must have everything new once a week and no accounting. Of course, you can't do it in peacetime, you see. And then there somebody came from outside and checked the weapons, and a few weapons were missing. I don't think there was any leakage to bandits. It was just normal sort of wartime administration when things were written off. In peacetime, you cannot write off rifles, bazookas, brain guns, ammunition. You can't do it. Right. And so he signed for that camp, which was for a headquarters squadron and two others. There were five squadrons. So two squadrons had to be kept permanently in the jungle because there was no sleeping accommodation for them.